I came up to a choice over the last meeting.
Today is February 9th, 2017. This is a Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we're going to do a continuation of the agency overview with Director Saxon, and then hopefully we will shift into the health systems divisions once we get through with this wonderful set of PowerPoint slides, and then we'll go to another set. Exciting. I love it when my day starts off with two sets of PowerPoint. So, Director, whenever you are ready. I think Dr. Bueller actually wanted to follow up and had some questions before we got started.
I'll let you finish this slide.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. I do want to introduce Kate Nass from our finance team, who joins us today. Budget Director Evans is struggling with the cold that seems to permeate Oregon right now. So pleased to have Kate here. I do want to give just a recognition. My name is Lynn Saxton. I'm sorry. And I do want to give some recognition. Kate is someone who has multiple budget talents and also has played a major role in the overall state budget. Before she joined our agency, I've worked with her both as a volunteer and in my current role, and she is a tremendous asset to financial management in our state, and we're thrilled to have her on our team. This is the report, kind of the summary of Health System Transformation 2.0 for Oregonians slide. It does have our bestseller slide. This is our number one top-selling slide, is this green map of Oregon showing the incidence and prevalence of Medicaid usage across the state. It was a big surprise when we first released it, and I think has really focused some important discussions in the agency. We talked yesterday about our priority of maintaining health coverage, addressing causes of poor health, and achieving sustainable funding. We talked about achieving the waiver, continuing the coordinated care model. There is in the waiver a renewed effort to paying for value. This is a national focus point, and we in Oregon hope to continue to lead innovative models that ensure we're paying for performance. Obviously, we have a number of those models in place already. I'll stop there and respond to questions.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you. Director, I think it's apparent that we all are seeing the value of the social determinants of health. Can you outline the metrics that we have for the CCOs for impacting social determinants?
So, yes, I think what I'd like to do in response to that question, Representative Bueller, is to give you the metrics that we have and the performance, show you that chart. There, in my mind, and in Director Clement's mind, who does the Health Policy and Analytics Division work, there is, in the first round of metrics that were established, there were some notable gaps in terms of sufficient metrics to drive performance. One was in the area of behavioral health, and the other is in looking at social determinants of health. I will use as one of the success stories, though, and having served on the Early Learning Council, I got to see this transition in action, was the indicator of kindergarten readiness assessment, right? And when the CCOs were first given that metric and said, okay, one of the things we're going to measure to is kindergarten readiness, they were like, wait, we're in healthcare. And they are actually now the biggest proponents of that social determinant of health metric in their metrics, because they saw that it did, it makes a profound difference in the health and well-being of those youth going forward. So we will get you the full list of metrics and the performance level, but we would, and our metrics committee, which is has statewide representation and includes physicians and others, we would be the first to say that it is time to take a fresh look at those metrics and also to a discussion you're going to hear later in our presentation. We also, as a state, have to consolidate our metrics so that our physicians aren't overwhelmed with everyone producing a different set of metrics, and that work is underway as well.
Thank you.
Leslie Clement, Director Clement, will talk more about that in her presentation.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just a quick question and a serious question. You mentioned that this slide was a surprise, since we've been doing this since 1994. What do you mean by that? Meaning, is it the number, the 4-in-1 Oregonians, or the county distribution of where they're at? What was surprising to OHA about this and why?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I don't think it was surprising at all to the Oregon Health Authority. I think it was surprising to the public.
Okay.
3 years ago, when the number of births in Oregon on an annual basis were more, over 50% of the births in Oregon were Medicaid births. For people like me, who's a fifth-generation Oregonian, I was staggered by that statistic. When I came to the agency, I began to look at where is poverty embedded, and I think when we released this, we weren't surprised because we're up close with this data on a weekly basis. But many, many communities have told us that they are surprised that you have counties like Jefferson County with that high of a reliance on Medicaid.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up along that, in looking at the poverty issue that you raised, is there any, or did your agency or any other do the trends of when we moved from a robust economy like the counties of Jefferson? And I'm thinking of those timber counties that actually do not, before in the old days when they were allowed to actually do timber harvest and what have you, didn't fall in the category of being poverty counties. And I don't think that as we look at policy and some of the other issues, that we've gone back and looked at what were some of the drivers that has created in this state, poverty. And I don't know whether your agency or what other agency or whether we mirror that when we're talking about particularly the issue of poverty.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, it's a fascinating question you raise. Our agency does look at these numbers and those trend lines for the state. Poverty is the single largest determinant of poor health. And actually, some work we're doing right now on the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative gives us a lens into that. It is I would also say it's a very complex study in Oregon, and I would not suggest that we are expert in the evolution of poverty and where it exists. However, we do track those trend lines, and it is important to know that this is part of the kind of the national experience of the intensified pressure on the middle class over the last 10, 15 years, and that's borne out in our data.
Please continue.
Okay. So, I think part of what I want to call out in, and this reflects our data orientation to addressing the behavioral health challenge in the state, Oregon has some really sobering indicators in terms of behavioral health. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds in Oregon. In 2012-2013, our youth suicide rank was 14th highest among all U.S. states. We rank fourth nationally in opioid use. I don't have the date on that statistic, and I'd be happy to get it back to you because we have been making significant progress. Only 46% of adults experiencing a mental health issue received treatment in the previous year. One of the issues that we're particularly concerned about and have some people working on, we've been doing some of this work with Representative Hayden, is people who've served in military service, connecting them, making access to care available to them in a way that they can get it is important, and we have a challenge there. And finally, the 14.6% of adolescents experienced a major depressive episode in the previous year. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Saxon, the first three are, to my mind, we can understand how we could address those, right? Those are we get more services in place, we improve our opioid prescribing practices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Those are later. I'm really interested in this last statistic to understand why our adolescents are more prone to depression. And do we have any ideas, or should I leave that for Dr. Shahan or for when you talk more about behavioral health, or what's the plan for talking with us a little bit more about that one?
I think both we can, Dr. Shahan can talk to you more about it. I would want to say, just from having being someone who spent 13 years with acutely depressed adolescents in Oregon, is that in our analysis of that phenomenon in our state, there are some leading indicators. Obviously, we know poverty has a role to play there. Obviously, we know that family structure plays a role there. We also know that we're living in a time period where nationally 20% of youth have some emotional behavior challenge, which is abnormally high for the country overall. And we know that's tied to exercise. We know that's tied to screen time. There's a number of factors that come together to produce those numbers. And I think what we're very excited about in the Behavioral Health Collaborative is we have now seen some communities in Oregon that have taken that on head on, in terms of we need to understand what our youth need in our community on a daily basis, and between the CCOs, community mental health organizations, nonprofits, schools, churches, etc., we need to target those youth for support services. I know the example that another example besides Hood River would be in Albany, which has a very high incidence and prevalence of poverty. I spent a lot of time in Albany. My husband's family is there. And, for example, they have taken direct measures at the high school in Albany to ensure, at several of the high schools, to ensure that all youth from the point of entry have support for all the aspects required for education, which includes, if your family's falling apart and you're going to high school, you need some help keeping your life together so that you can keep high school together. So we have some very good models around the state where multi-tiered interventions have been provided to adolescents to make sure they cross the finish line. And I think that's what it's going to take. I think these numbers are alarming.
Quick follow-up, if I could. Thank you. That's really helpful, and it leads me to then a second question when you talk about communities taking this on. I have no expectation that every intervention be conducted like a randomized control trial. However, However, we had a conversation in here yesterday, and we will be having the conversation throughout this year, that we need to have evidence about what's working and what's not, mm-hmm. and what's worth investments and what's not.
Oh my God.
Here, if you click on this little sound thingy right there and then slide it all the way down to that end, it'll stop making noise at you. There you go. Just keep going down. There we go. Okay, good. Technical, new computers. We all have new computers
understand.
This year. So I guess my question is, I think we have some really, really engaged, intelligent folks out there in a range of communities. Not every community has the experience of tracking implementation of new interventions and tracking the outcomes of those so that we can generalize. In public safety yesterday, the Department of the DPSST folks were testifying, and they were talking about their policing excellence thing where they have this knowledge base. I know that OHA has analogous sites for people. So I guess I'm curious about how you're helping those communities track the efficacy of their interventions and then disseminate that knowledge.
So, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I think there's two things. One is, I think we believe that our health policy and analytics division is helping some communities do that now, and we'll do more of that in the future when the collaborative's recommendations come out. I would, again, I'll use Hood River as an example. Hood River was just recognized by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for community excellence in integrating effort to outcomes. And so they, in that community, not a huge community, by collaborating across all the service providers and the community effectively, they're now able to look at collective impact and outcomes. So I think we have, I think the CCOs are very interested in helping us do this. I think they have the infrastructure to do it. I think the CMHAs are at the table to help us do this, and I think we see a way forward. Part of the challenge of doing that, I was involved in one of the first Robert Wood Johnson projects to integrate community impact in Multnomah County in the 90s, and part of the way to do that is to not make it overly complicated,
to use
simple data systems, and we're committed to that, and we're also committed that there's kind of some starting points you can create in local communities without going to the big, huge, perfect data nirvana.
Which is actually worse. That's the perfect thing.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Right. One of my experiences is that teenage years and mental health problems have a whole lot to do with abuse and neglect that they have experienced. I've worked within the Healthy Families model, and that is what they totally target, is putting their resources towards those youth that have had those experiences. And if you direct your services and education around that, you get way better, you know, measurable outcomes. So when we're talking about what causes all this depression, a whole lot of it is the abuse that they've suffered.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Representative, for that reminder. You're absolutely right, and we're going to have those people at the that community helping us address this issue. And I think those numbers, actually, I didn't bring them today, but those numbers are also quite sobering.
Yes, they are.
The incidence and prevalence of abuse and neglect.
All right, Representative Alonso León.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair. My question is around kind of both the last two bullets. I think that we still have a stigma around behavioral health and misunderstanding. What is the state doing to help educate folks so that people get help? Because I'm assuming, I mean, there's this 1 in 6 Oregonians experience mental illness. I would say probably higher, right? If people felt comfortable about seeking help or didn't carry that stigma. And this is the same with our young people. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to hear from you what the state is doing to help educate folks. And then I'm assuming there's a need for practitioners to help as
yes.
well. So can you?
Yes. So thank you, Representative. Co-chairs, two things. One, I would suggest that perhaps the single biggest step the state has in terms of state efforts made in reducing stigma is the patient-centered primary care home, where patients are patients, and regardless what services they're getting, they get them holistically. They get them from a care team that understands that physical health affects mental health, that social pressures can totally set aside your physical health, your behavioral health. So that's a critical step. I will say again that we hope to make further progress in other areas because you're absolutely right, we're not there yet. Secondly, in terms of the workforce issues, one of the things Director Clement's team is working on, and the Oregon Health Policy Board has really done foundational work in the workforce challenges that we face in Oregon for the healthcare community, and the behavioral health aspect of that is one of the most serious. The generation that went into social services in the 60s is retiring, and the millennials are not going into the field as much as the previous generation, so we have real work to do there. The good news is through the work of the Oregon Health Policy Board, we've scoped the challenge. We will further scope the challenge and have a plan to make progress, but it's going to be hard work, and it's going to require Oregon to be able to compete with other states in terms of quality of care, which I think we're well positioned to do. I do believe that we are going to have to look in the coming year at rural Oregon and the Medicaid requirements for behavioral health services, and perhaps get additional waivers for the requirements of Medicaid as applied in rural areas. We did have this conversation with the U.S. Department of Justice about what is really realistic in some parts of the states in terms of the credentialing of the workforce, et cetera. So that's on our radar screen as a challenge as well. We have much work to do.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you.
Co-chair, just very briefly, I know we have a lot of material to get through. Is this type of information also provided to the CCOs for their communities? And my concern being is as we move to kind of a standardized method of matrix so that we have better data coming back, is there an unintended consequences or a risk of some communities not knowing or having the information specifically, like if that 14.6 is for the state, you know, maybe in Grant County or something, it's 20 or something like
right.
that. Do they get that type of feedback from you on individual county by basis, mm-hmm. and will they have flexibility in their matrix to target those types of things going forward?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, they get it not to the extent that will be possible when we complete our behavioral health mapping work with the Farley Center from University of Colorado that I mentioned yesterday. Their tool is even better than what we created, and it's going to allow them to zoom in on that data. And particularly, I think we are very attuned to having the discussion with the CCOs about do they need to apply resources differently in different areas to get to those areas of higher prevalence of problem and disease or behavioral health issues. So yes, we're not fully where we want to be in doing what you just asked us to do, but we are on the track to do that, and we're making progress, and we'll have more and more of that available. And of course, we'll make that information available to our team that works on the metrics. That's the opportunity of what we've built here.
Senator Gilzer.
You hit me. I'm
okay. All right, please continue.
Thank you. Okay, the Office of Equity and Inclusion is a division of the Oregon Health Authority. They are working on a number of initiatives that were envisioned in the startup of the ACA and the implementation of health system transformation in Oregon. These include what is known as REAL-D, which is the collection of race, ethnicity, language, and disability demographic data that folds into the work with our data system, the one eligibility system, and we do that work. We have a work team. We do that work in partnership with the Department of Human Services. They are working on alternate format and language access services policy, recruitment and retention of a diverse workforce. We hold ourselves accountable at the management level of the Oregon Health Authority. We look at our diversity recruiting on a monthly basis by division to ensure that we are making progress in that area. And I think we've made some. We haven't made enough. But we see it, and we are acting on it. And again, culturally and linguistically appropriate services. They are the Office of Equity and Inclusion coordinates with the regional health equity coalitions around the state, and also focus on the need for not only traditional healthcare workers, but healthcare interpreters. So we are fortunate to have this capacity in the agency. It was built at startup, and it is a team of professionals committed to achieving these objectives and to truly achieve health equity, which, as you see in this chart, there's a difference between equality and equity. So we're focused on this. We have a ways to go in this field, and we have a robust data set on our website that reflects where we are today and where we intend to get to.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Winters.
I promised Senator Gordley when she left, because this was actually one of her passions, I mean a major passion, of the whole issue of race disparities in the state. And so it's every session we discuss, where are you? where are you going, and when is it one day we're not going to have this discussion? And I'm, you know, we always talk in terms that we're doing collaboration, and particularly in the area of recruitment and retention. You know, if we don't have individuals who look like the groups that we're talking about that's delivering the services, you know, someone talked about the whole issue of the stigmata on mental health, for example. If there isn't enough of a work pool out there to be able to talk to the individuals, it's very difficult to get that message across that sticks. So I that was one of the promises that I made, that I would continue this conversation. Mm-hmm. And hopefully one day we won't have to talk about this conversation anymore. There, you know, not just for Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, but throughout the fabric of Oregon. Mm-hmm. So just, and I'm glad that you're taking some steps and what have you, but we've got a long, long way to go. Mm-hmm. And I know that somebody's going to be helping.
Okay, here's where the rubber meets the road. This is the total authority agency budget. The priorities are to maintain services for children and families, protect eligibility and benefits, establish a sustainable future for Medicaid. I want to underscore that. That's a personal passion for me. When we stood up the ACA, we stood it up on one-time funds, and we knew, and it was represented in the ACA, that the federal funding for the expansion population would decline over time. And this is a year where that decline has begun. Obviously, the $1 billion budget gap, which we are all collectively dealing with, is front and center for us. This budget that you see to the right shows our 2015-17 legislatively adopted budget and the agency's budget and the governor's budget. You see that the other state funding component requirement increases in 17-19 biennium. You see federal funds decreasing, and but you see that the actual total fund goes from 20.6 to $20.4 billion. I do want to call out, and I'm fully respectful of the fact that with the budget gap, it's not the focal point of our efforts, but the agency has exercised considerable discipline over the last 2 years and is now seeing the benefit of what was, I think, a difficult and painful restructure in 15-17. Without that restructure, we would have even more of a challenge today. We have the strategies to come forward with a model for funding Medicaid include reducing administrative overhead, closing the Junction City Hospital in 2018. They reflect new revenue from hospitals, CCOs, and insurers, and an increase in the price of tobacco, which, as we discussed yesterday, is Oregon's leading health challenge. So I'll stop there, and there are probably many questions you may have on this piece of the slide.
Yeah, Representative Bueller.
Dr. Saxon, I appreciate you looking at efficiencies within the agency. Have you evaluated how many of your services could be contracted out to private sources or nonprofit that would be able to deliver equivalent services at a much lower cost?
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, thank you. Have we done a comprehensive analysis of all the things that could be done in the private and nonprofit sector? No, we have not done that comprehensive analysis. I will say for the last 2 years, we have a number of our services already are contracted to the nonprofit sector. And in the last 2 years, we have used opportunities to contract with the private and the private nonprofit sector as the contracts, our labor contracts, and other requirements allow us to do. So, for example, we have used in the call center operation and meeting the CMS guidelines and expectations, we've contracted with KPMG, we've contracted with PH Tech and Shaw's to supplement efforts of our state workforce to meet critical federal deadlines. But we have not done a comprehensive agency-wide assessment.
Good.
Please.
So how many call and center employees do you have within OHA right now? Do you have any idea?
Dr. Shahan?
480.
And what's that total budget?
For that, just that segment of the call center, I can get you that information. I don't have it right now. I don't have it off the top of my head. I don't know if you guys have it. Okay, we'll get it.
That'd be great.
Yep.
Senator Gilzer.
Thank you.
Can I just add, projections of the one implementation over time, again, it's a peak to get the system up, and then the labor component of that operation declines over time. Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. Dr. Saxon, going back to the issue of Junction City, which is on this slide, in your strategy to close the hospital in 2018, what would happen with the maintenance and operating costs of the facility? If it closes, does that remain in the Oregon Health Authority budget, or does that shift to DAS or someplace else, or are we spending Health Authority dollars maintaining an empty building?
Co-Chair Senator Gelser, there are a number of people interested in the state hospital in Junction City that have expressed interest in perhaps using the facility for other purposes. I understand that was part of the discussion when the hospital was built. So we will do that assessment, first of all, looking at, is there other state services that could be done there? It's a really remarkable facility. We did look at using the facility when we had a crisis in children's care this year. We looked at using the cottages, which are very, very well done for those needs. There are DHS has had a number of program closures where it's been discussed that we could put those programs into some of the facilities at the state hospital. And so I think there are both private and public sector opportunities for the Junction City facility, and we would need to explore those. We will certainly also explore what just the empty building carrying costs would be. We can get those numbers.
Follow-up?
Please.
Two, that raised a question. I'm alarmed by the idea that DHS would put people in an institutional setting since we've closed all of our institutions for people with intellectual disabilities. Who exactly are they?
So just to be clear, Director Psyche, I don't want him to, I don't want to create a problem for him. Not in the building itself, but in the cottages. So that's where the children facilities have been looked at. Both the state hospital has cottages in the perimeter that could be used that look very much like other residential programs for children in Oregon.
Okay, so as a follow-up, a lot of times when you say DHS institution, that immediately goes to IDDD. You're speaking specifically of kids' mental health.
Yes.
Great. And then the last follow-up.
Please.
Thank you. Do we have any, kind of as a state, do we have any outstanding obligation to the municipality in Junction City around infrastructure costs or any development charge forgiveness that they may have given to us around building water pipes and sewage? And is that also considered in the cost savings?
Senator Gelser, excellent question. I don't know the answer to that, and we'll get the information.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Winters.
Thank you. I'm going to just to follow along with the question on private contracting, and you can bring the information back. But what percentage of the contracting that is done by OHA that is private, and that's the dollar amount, how much are you actually doing on the private side? And I don't mean the CCOs now, because that's a whole separate, organizational piece. And then what percentage of those dollars are minority and women?
So, co-chairs, Senator Winters, we will get that information. Our CFO is here today, and we'll capture that and get that back to
Thanks.
You.
All right. Please continue.
Okay. Okay? Yep. So, I'm going to have... Thank you. Kate's going to talk a little bit about our budget breakdown. So.
Yeah. Good morning. For the record, I'm Kate Nass. I'm the Deputy Director of Finance and Budget at the Oregon Health Authority.
And I am filling in for Janelle Evans, who I think would rather be here than where she is battling the flu, but I, you never know. So, so bear with me as I kind of do a high level, and feel free to ask questions. So, this is a chart or a donut chart of the total agency budget for, as proposed in the governor's budget for the health authority, broken down by our program, our budget structure programs. As you can see, 74% of our budget goes to the health systems division. That's where the Oregon Health Plan is, the non-Medicaid, the community mental health programs. So the majority of our funds go through there. The other big ones that we have that are to note are both PEB and OEB. They are $1.9 billion and another $1.7 billion, respectively. So that that's kind of where the major portion is. That's all purchasing health care. I mean, that's where the majority of our money goes. You can see that we do have Public Health Division has about 3%. Oregon State Hospital is also around 3%. And then we have 2%. For our kind of central operations, DAS service charges, all that kind of stuff. And then lastly, health policy analytics has the 1%.
Just 1 second. Co-chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I apologize, Ms. Ness. I just want to point out to my colleagues, this slide is a great example about how things get double counted. And in particular, I would point out the PEB and OEB segments, because those are essentially general fund dollars. And what they are, the general fund dollars that we put towards paying the employees at OHA and DHS, or all of us, and all of our benefits that come out of that, which are all part of general fund appropriations for the most part. There are some differences. Some of it comes from, it's general fund. It may come from different sources. So I'm not, and that's one of the reasons that the legislature made a decision to hold OEB and PEB accountable to the same 3.4% inflation rate that we hold Medicaid to, because we think we owe the citizens of the state that kind of accountability and that kind of thoughtfulness in how we deliver medical care to state employees and to OEB beneficiaries. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Ness, but I think as we have a pretty new committee, so we're just trying to point out some of the ways that these things show up. And so that budget shows you very clearly how money shows up in multiple budgets. Some of that money comes from the legislative branch budget, right? Some of it comes from the K-12 budget.
Thank you,
Senator. You'll see it listed as other funds.
Right.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Sanger. That's a perfect example. But yeah, the funding source for both PEB and OEB, PEB comes from how employees for the state are paid as well, and OEB comes as assessment or as premiums collected from school districts or community colleges, and who's for the employees' lives and members that are covered under those health plans. And they are counted as other funds because they come to us from the other agencies or school districts. And just, I'm going to go back to this one really quick. I do want to note that you'll get a lot more detail on each of these budget structures over the next couple of weeks. So that will come, I promise. this is our...
So let me just offer one more thing here. So one of the things that the Oregon Health Authority has, co-chairs, is a really exceptionally clear budget staff. They are very good at translation and peeling back. And so any of you that would like individual meetings or presentations, we're happy to do that. And I would encourage you, it's a complex, very large budget, and we're happy to sit down and go through that work. And there are no wrong questions about our budget. It really takes wading in. So let us help you with that as you wish.
Thank you.
I just volunteered.
I appreciate that. So this is the same $20.4 billion that we looked at in the last slide, only broken out by where the funding comes from. So this is the this shows that well over half of our budget, 57%, actually comes from federal sources. And that comes from anywhere from the Medicaid program to public health grants to all of that. So it's a large portion. The majority of our budget is from federal funds. The next biggest one is other funds. The primary source there is what we just talked about with Senator Sanger Hayward, which is the PEB and OEB. Majority of that is from PEB and OEB premiums and assessments. And then lastly, we have the or not lastly, we have general fund at around $2.2 billion, 11%, and then we have lottery funding for addiction services. And then lastly, this shows, because we kind of focus on general fund, this focuses our general fund by program area. It shows a little bit of a different picture than what we showed two donuts ago, which was our total fund budget. This shows that 68% of our general fund goes to the health systems division, and that's our Medicaid program and our non-Medicaid or community mental health programs. But a larger portion of our general fund does go to the Oregon State Hospital due to the services and how they're largely generally funded. So this kind of pie chart or donut looks different when you change the fund source or the whether or not you're looking at total or general.
Put your stand here with.
I realize it will probably come to this another time, but it just occurs to me to wonder. I know that after adjudication, when people are incarcerated, they're not eligible for Medicaid, right? That's on the county or the state, depending on where they're incarcerated. But our 370 population, which are on aid and assist and are pre-adjudication, who pays for those? Is that Medicaid, or is that the state, or is that the counties who got them in there on pre-adjudication?
So, go ahead. So, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you, or Chair Rayfield, Senator Steiner Hayward. So we'll get back to you exactly on it, but largely it's the state. We'll get back to you on exactly what's going on with that, but it's largely the state being paid for that.
So co-chairs, we will get back to you. It's part of the challenge is, and I want to underscore because we need to not forget this, the federal government is not a fan of state hospitals.
Right.
There are many states that don't have state hospitals, and so there are pretty rigid rules about where Medicaid will go into and not.
Okay.
Madam Chair, and it would, Mr. Chair.
Please.
It would be helpful, actually, for staff, two things, to actually get the overarching policy federally. The federals came down years and years ago. They were not going to actually fund with Medicaid institutional care. And that's the, you know, so it's whether it's the state hospital or it's the prison. We do not get Medicaid match for DOC either.
Right.
They put them both in the same category. And Ms. Ames, could you help? I'd like to go back to the pie chart on the Oregon Health Authority agency budget 2017 and 2019.
Senator Winters, I believe the correct term is a donut chart.
Oh, the donut chart. And I like Dunkin'.
Which is not a healthy kind of reference, just for the record.
Okay. Or Krispy Kreme. Could you, and you don't have to, you know, bring it for us, because I just noticed that we're now at 57% federal funds. Could you provide us with that donut for 2015 back to 2013 to show this committee how funding shifting has changed? I think it's something that is noteworthy from where we are shifting from the amount of federal dollars to state and other funds.
Thank you, Senator Winters. Just really quick, we have some of those slides on the different divisions, so you'll see it by division, but I think it would be helpful to roll it up into the full agency as well.
Yeah, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. Co-chairs. On the federal budget, 11.6 on this donut chart, do we have calculated in there the remainder or the tail end of the transformation funds from the last 1115 waiver calculated into that? And as we look forward to the new waiver that got approved on January 12th, is there any consideration for fluctuation or potential additional dollars in your state budget? Not in the state budget, but in the federal portion of it.
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, I'm confirming the 1.9
is that what you're referring to?
That we got in the first waiver is not in this budget. It's exhausted in the 15-17 biennium.
Right.
So just to be clear on that. And in the new waiver
that doesn't end until June 30th, correct?
Right. At the end of this biennium that money is exhausted. In the new waiver, I think there was some media coverage saying we didn't get any money with the new waiver, and that was that's not accurate. We didn't get any money in the new waiver, but we were told in the previous waiver that we would not get the money again. CMS was very clear about that. The first meeting I had with CMS in Baltimore, they said, now remember, Oregon, we told you this is a one-time thing, and that's what you're getting is that $1.9 billion. Now, the piece that is critical is an opportunity for us, and not that we can bank on it, but I think it's a real opportunity, is Oregon's model is producing shared savings for the federal government. And so in our conversations with them, both about this waiver and going forward, we've talked to them about some of the operating models that we have in Oregon and that they generate shared savings for the federal government. Would they be interested in reinvesting, effectively providing CMS venture capital to continue those models and realize those gains? And I think they are interested in having those conversations. So that's a go-forward conversation that we absolutely are prepared and planning on having with CMS. But in terms of and they're very clear that that 1.9 was not to fill operating losses. It was to advance system transformation, which we successfully did. So we need to be clear. CMS is not interested in backfilling. Mm-hmm. They're interested in driving change. And so that's where our opportunity is going forward.
Right. Please continue.
So I think that's it. That's the last of my. We can start calling them orange slice charts, maybe, for the health authority. I don't know.
All right. Are there any questions before we transition?
And Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, so the new presentation, which will start Health Systems Division, is posted on OLS for today, the 9th. I can vouch that it works.
I was confused.
And that will go through all of next week.
And maybe I'll bring donuts.
We're going to show up early.
Those of us who are trying really hard to avoid the session, and would appreciate your not doing that, Senator.
So, Director Sachs, thank you guys. Appreciate it. So if you guys have questions, you can follow up offline. And now we'll go ahead and bring up the Health Systems Division, Dr. Shahan and team.
I apologize, co-chairs and committee. I was to introduce Dr. Shahan and Director Clement, so I'm now introducing them. This is Dr. Shahan, leader of the health systems team, and Director Clement, who runs health policy and analytics. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the records, I'm Dr. Varsha Chauhan, Chief Health Systems Officer for Oregon Health Authority. I've been here for 1 year, but to be very honest, a disclaimer here, the last 1 year I have spent is in member services, helping the one system to be implemented in the right way that it should be. So I was just telling Director Saxton and Leslie, it feels like a new job coming back after 1 year. So just a disclaimer, I will do my best to answer any questions. If not, I have the privilege today to work with my peers who are very knowledgeable in all the key information within Health System Division. And our goal will be to provide you not only information, but answer any of your questions, or I'll assure that we come back with any other information that I do not have here today. So moving into it, the first slide talks about the Health System Division's purpose. Okay, I have different slides here. The purpose of the Health System Division, which really aligns with the mission statement and the vision of Oregon Health Authority, is to build and advance a system of care to create healthy Oregon. What this captures the elements of health system division's work to develop programs that compose the health system along with developing and improving the health system, the systems itself. As the chief health system officer, my vision is to ensure that systematic healthcare transformation in the coordinated care model occurs in the coordinated care organization level, and the state operations are effective, efficient, and fiscally sustainable. There are some very high-level goals here on the slide. Again, not the only goals in the health system division, but really very high-level, which is to provide access to health care for more than 1 million Oregonians, provide better care, better health at lower costs through the use of the coordinated care model through our coordinated care organizations, provide oversight and ensure compliance with federal regulations for all Medicaid programs, including those that are operated by the Department of Human Services, and support and oversee the behavioral health safety net and infrastructure delivered by the counties. I will get into details of the HSD program later in the presentation, but I would like to give some examples of what actually the health system division is responsible for. The entire team collectively oversees Oregon's healthcare access delivery system, including the Oregon Health Plan, which provides more than 1 million Oregonians with healthcare access that they need. We implement programs such as hospice and home health for Oregon Health Plan members. We enroll, train, and support all the Medicaid providers in the state. We partner with the Department of Human Services to coordinate care across spectrum of services through all the life cycles or ages. Work with the coordinated care organizations, the units of local government, tribes, and private organizations to implement healthcare in an effective and efficient manner throughout the state. We also manage encounter data that is submitted to us by the coordinated care organizations, which informs the rate setting process. We manage several contracts, which provides care coordination for our fee-for-service or open card members. So those were just some very high-level examples of where the health system division spends most of its time. Any questions at this time before I move to the next slide? Okay, thank you. Moving into giving you an update on the org chart here, there are five main sections under the health system division, and I'll walk you through each one of them and pause after each section to take any questions. The first one is the integrated health programs division. The integrating physical, oral, and behavioral health is really critical to success of Oregon's coordinated care model, as we all know. The integrated health program section, it drives the integration at Oregon Health Authority, including overseeing program development and operational policies. This section has three teams which focus both on Medicaid and non-Medicaid funded physical, dental, and behavioral health programs, development, operational policy, and special projects. The medical and dental operation policy staff, they spend their time designing, developing, implementing, monitoring, and maintaining Medicaid, medical, and dental services programs to comply with state and federal regulations. The second team is the adult and child and family behavioral health team, who provides oversight, contract administration, and direction in the areas of child, young adult, and older adult behavioral health service elements. This encompasses substance use disorder, mental health, problem gambling services, including screening and early intervention, community-based outpatient, residential, inpatient, crisis stabilization, emergency services, housing, and recovery supports. Many of these services are tailored to specific populations, such as juvenile and adult forensic populations, civilly committed individuals we were talking about, children and families who are involved in multiple systems, young adults in transition, and older adults. In addition, the staff provides legislative analysis and coordinates the administrative rules process. This section also performs analysis that helps management make decisions about the implementation and operations of the division's healthcare programs. The research and analysis are focused on translating strategic policy direction, which comes from Director Clement's shop, into programs and services that are ready for providers to implement and members to access. Any question on this integrated health programs section in the health system division and what they do? Okay. Moving to the next, which is the member... I'm still on the org chart.
Oh, sorry.
The member services, where I have spent the last 1 year, has three major functions. The first one is to operate the Oregon Health Plan. There are a few things that what it means when operates the Oregon Health Plan. They're really responsible for processing of applications, renewals, redeterminations for over 1 million members. This team provides technical support for the applicant portal that Director Saxton mentioned yesterday, aiding members with self-services of case detail and information. The team administers case management for special populations like breast and cervical cancer program, dual eligibility, retro medical requests. They provide post-eligibility case management, manage adjustments to the coordinated care organization enrollments, and also provide customer support for members and community partners. The second biggest function carried on by the member services section is that they train and support a network of community partner organizations and assisters around the state who help Oregonians apply and use for the Oregon Health Plan benefits. Currently, we are supporting around over 800 community partners and volunteers who provide support and assistance to some of our most vulnerable and underrepresented population, which are refugees and immigrants, homeless, and disabled individuals. The member services team, during my work with them, I noticed that they include people with specialized eligibility expertise. We also have policy analysts in the team who deal with rules and audits and respond to questions from legislators and other stakeholders. They provide ongoing review of procedures and systems enhancements to ensure that we are in compliance with all the relevant policies by the federal or the state. I'll talk about our new one eligibility system later in the presentation. Any questions on the member services section? Okay. Moving on to the third section in Health System Division, which is Provider Services Office. The Provider Services Unit, it provides enrollment and service support for providers and operational support for the coordinated care organizations. They enroll, train, and support all the Medicaid providers. They process claims and all the encounter data. They develop and implement policies, procedures, and program priorities for coordinated care support programs. They provide system and operational support for all the coordinated care organizations. And finally, they provide case management and utilization management for the fee-for-service population for physical health, behavioral health, and oral health. Before I move into the fourth section under Health System Division, any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Dr. Shahan,
yes.
Thank you. I haven't looked through your entire presentation yet. I probably should have, but will you be going into a little bit more detail about each of those functions over the course of the rest of your presentation? What does that really mean to the case management? For example, I'm just picking something out of thin air. Do the case management for the fee-for-service population, or is that pretty much what we're going to hear in terms of what they're doing, or we can understand a little bit more about the structure of those divisions?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I would be covering some points and throughout the presentation, but not specifically. I'll be more than happy during the presentation if you see anything specific where you need more details. I'll be happy to get that information.
Okay, thanks.
And I just a quick question. How many people do you have currently on the open card?
I will have to get that information back to you.
Okay, thank you.
A follow-up to that question, Mr. Chair.
Open card.
Yeah, and what's your target? What do you think is the right percentage of your OHP population to be on open card as opposed to in CCOs?
I will make sure I get that information tomorrow when I'm in the next session when I am back.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, a portion of that same question really came up yesterday, and the agency is working on that.
Great.
And the one thing that I might mention as well is as you guys are going through the presentations, I mean, part of the reality of what we're looking at is how are the cuts, as we look at going to impact some of these things. So if there are areas that you want to emphasize based upon the development of your 15% cuts list, please feel free to elaborate on some of that stuff and provide more information to the committee as we go through.
Stop.
Well, just if they could supply more information, yeah.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we do, co-chair. Should I refer to that?
Sure.
Co-chair and a member of the committee, I have just been shared this information that in the Oregon Health Plan demographics that was shared with you, we do have some of the information on the open card members that could be enrolled, which is around 149,984, which is 15.1%. And that document was shared.
And if I may, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Representative Hayden brought this up yesterday, and I couldn't agree with him more. How do you feel about that number? And what would you do if you like it? Why? And if you don't, what would you rather have it be? And what are you doing to get it to this better number?
Go ahead. So I would read. I would have Director Clements take that question.
So
can you just introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry. Leslie Clement, the Director of Health Policy and Analytics. So this information is in the most recent legislative quarterly report, and I hope you all have received it. You can see that there's some categories that fee-for-service fall into. Some of those categories we're actively working with the CCOs to see how we can move those members into the CCOs. There's a bucket that I think we want to be candid about and just say it's bigger than it should be, and we need to, these are not exempt populations. There are certain people that you can't assign to CCOs. And for example, tribal members, they have the option to be in the open card. And so there's a proportion of members in fee-for-service who will always be there because they're exempt.
Right.
I don't have the math, and we'll get back to you on that number. But a couple of things to point out. In the most recent waiver that's just been renewed, we asked for the ability to change the policy on individuals who also have Medicare coverage. They were previously in this category called an opt-in. So they would just normally not be enrolled in a CCO unless they specifically requested to enroll in a CCO. We ask that that policy be switched to an opt-out, which would allow us to automatically enroll them into a CCO. And if they didn't want to be, they would tell us. It's just what we have to do working with the federal laws. We think that that will significantly increase the numbers of those Medicare and Medicaid called duals into CCOs. So that should help. The other conversation we're having with our CCOs right now that's actually being led by the Provider Services Director in Health Services Division is the third-party coverage group. So if an individual today comes onto the Medicaid program and has other commercial health insurance, they're in fee-for-service. And that was an arrangement that was originally negotiated with CCOs when they were first stood up. And now the conversation with CCOs is, do you really want that to continue? And I think there's some legitimate interest at this time to have those individuals be moved into the CCOs as well.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
You're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, Director Clements.
Sure.
But, I have a recollection of a hearing in the Senate Health Committee, I think during May legislative days last year, when the company that manages our open card, Keypro, came in, and thank you, I blanked on the name. And at that point, we had 76,000 people on open card. What? Why is that almost double? I still don't understand. I mean, I understand some of these specific populations, but those are not different populations than they were 10 months ago.
Yeah. Co-chair, you're exactly right. There has been a significant increase. I'm not sure whether it was 70%, but it was less. At least maybe a few percentage points less than it is today. I think there's probably a number of factors, and the root cause analysis needs to occur. But for the longest time, the Medicaid program, working with the federal government, received a request to defer the redetermination process. That redetermination process has been going on now for several months, and you probably have this detail more than I do. When you've restarted all those applications that basically sat in the system for a long time with continuous coverage and you start to bring them up and look at them, there is a churning impact that has occurred. I don't know how much of that is attributed to this, and I'm not going to say, oh, it's all good, it's all fine. It's something that we have to look at and say, this is not right. We don't want as many people in this status in fee-for-service. We want more of those into CCOs, but we have to do a lot more work to dig through that and figure out what the root cause is.
Okay, I have a zillion more questions on this, but I'm not going to belabor the point right now.
And I have one question specifically, just kind of to get at this in terms of what's the average cost difference between maintaining an open card individual on for a biennium versus maintaining, you know, healthcare through a CCO?
It's a good question, co-chair. We can get back to you with that information, and we would do like an average per member per month cost compared to fee for service and CCOs. Sure,
that'd be great.
Representative Hayden,
thank you, co-chair. This is something that I've been working on in 2015, 2016, and we'll continue to work on. One of the populations that I've kind of drilled down into is the Callan population, where your member services have been able to do an excellent job at getting members hooked up with services. You know, in the 50, 60, and thank you for OHA getting me some additional information on percentages of that yesterday. And when you take that population, you can really see the results of what open card, some successes of what you have been able to accomplish there. But then you take another population, and particularly pregnant women in poverty, in the federal poverty level between 139 and 185%, and you look at the non-Callan population, which is in there, and that 60% that you were able to provide for the Callan population in getting access to care in 2015 drops to 9%. Same category of women, but just a different bucket within your own system. Why the precipitous drop off with pregnant women in that poverty level just because they're signed up with a different type of category? Why don't we see parity there? I mean, you're able to do it. You've done a great job, but you're not doing it for everybody.
So, co-chairs and Representative Hayden, this is really something that we are aware of. And as Director Clements did mention, there are these areas that we are aware of and are at this time really doing a deep root cause analysis and trying to understand what are these trends and why these trends are. I should be able to get back with more clarity on what the root cause is. I hope in next, I wouldn't say within next week, but within next few weeks, we should be able to point out and put our finger on what is exactly happening here.
Okay, and just as a follow-up to the request that I'd ask about the cost differential, we might want to dig down just a little bit deeper in terms of the populations, because I think that will provide more accurate as opposed to doing an average, because there's some people with more complex medical that are going to be a lot higher. So I want to make sure we have that. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Moving to the fourth section under the Health System Division is the Business Information Technology section. This particular section manages all the information technology functions, including the Medicaid Management Information System, which most of us know as MMIS, and the one system that we have been talking about. And at this time, it's partnering with the Department of Human Services to build the integrated eligibility system. The team, a few things that the team is really mainly just responsible for is maximizing the effectiveness of the information technology systems, both within the health system division and the Oregon Health Authority. They develop and manage the governance of all the information technology strategies, justification and prioritization, and the funding of all the enhancements needed for these systems. They align with federal and state mandates for technology architecture, such as modularization and security. They also help with policy interpretation and system modifications as needed to ensure that we are in compliance with all the policy changes. They have oversight and implement all information technology projects and initiatives within Oregon Health Authority and in collaboration with all the sister agencies. They support all the federal and state audits that come our way, and they are also responsible for daily maintenance and operations of the systems I mentioned earlier, and play a significant role in managing our vendors and problem resolution. So that has the focus, and I will share a success story later on in this section that has happened recently. Any questions on this particular section that helps the systems, the wheels moving and turning? Okay, compliance regulations is the last section in the health system division. This section manages around over 330 contracts with the coordinated care organizations, community mental health providers, and the non-Medicaid programs. They oversee housing grants for, of worth $37.5 million for licensed residential and supported and supporting supportive housing. They inspect, license, and certify over 1,500 behavioral health and adult foster care programs in the state. They provide quality management for coordinated care organizations through coordination of quality review process and monitoring of the coordinated care organizations' work plans. They manage the grievance reporting and hearing process for all the Oregon Health Plan members. And last but not least, they oversee rental assistance for individuals with mental illness or substance use disorder. And that is the main function of that particular section. To summarize, in the end, to effectively do all this work, Health System Division requires 816 positions, about 807 FTE, full-time employees, in the next biennium. Any questions before we move from this slide? Okay, thank you. The next slide here is a summary of programs, and before I get slightly in detail into the programs here, I want to just summarize the previous slides and connect our mission and vision with Oregon Health Authority and how we are driving these programs. So Health System Division oversees regulatory and operational management of Oregon's health delivery system and manages the implementation and evaluation of multiple statewide programs and activities in support of Medicaid programs, including integrating and coordinating interagency activities. The Oregon Health Plan, it includes physical, behavioral, and oral health. The traditional Medicaid for Oregon Health Plan is for pregnant women, children, the aged, blind, disabled, also something known as TANF, which is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and eligible individuals in similar categories. The Medicaid expansion is for non-pregnant adults who are below the federal below the percent of federal poverty level that is set by Congress. In 2017, it was up to 138% of federal poverty level, or annual MAGI, which is the modified adjusted gross income of around $33,465 for a family of four. The next is Children's Health Insurance Program, which is known as CHIP. It's administered in Oregon through the Oregon Health Plan and not private insurance plans. And it provides coverage to children and families who have too much income to qualify for Medicaid. The children may qualify if their family's modified adjusted gross income, which is MAGI, is above 138% federal poverty level, up to 300% federal poverty level. The citizen alien, which is mentioned on the slide as CAWM, which is Citizen Alien Waived Emergent Medicaid Program, pregnancy or CAWM Plus prenatal, it covers all Oregon Health Plan benefits except for sterilizations, therapeutic abortions, hospice care, and death with dignity services. Except for these services, expenditures are matched with the federal Medicaid fund. I also wanted to, at this point, bring some more attention to the non-Medicaid behavioral health services, which includes mental health, substance use disorder, and problem gambling services. There are some programs for youth that we also oversee, which include depression screening, school access to mental health services, OPAL-K, which is Oregon Psychiatric Access, like about kids, Oregon Psychiatric Access Line About Kids, OPAL-K, Collaborative Problem Solving, CPS program, Parent-Child Interaction Therapy, which is the PCIT program, Youth Adult Co-Occurring Disorder Treatment, Trauma Initiative, Systems of Care and Wraparound Initiative, and Youth Victims of Sex Trafficking. Some other non-Medicaid behavioral health services for... I'm sorry.
Yeah, let me stop you there for a second. One thing I think it would be helpful as you go through these lists, we were just kind of looking through the slides, and since we have a lot of new people, maybe talking about the difference of the match rates between these populations might be helpful for the committee to understand.
So, co-chairs and members of the committee, we do have some further slides down the row where
we
will be bringing.
We missed them
those.
When we were looking. Yeah. Okay, then ignore me, please.
No problem. Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions?
I told you to ignore me.
Nice try. I'm sorry about that. Any other questions?
Yes,
quick question.
Teresa Wallace alone.
So I'm new to healthcare and I'm learning a lot. And I was just struck by the term or the phrase you use, citizen alien waived emergent medical. We're using the term citizen alien. Is that a federal term?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a federal term.
Wow. Wow.
And just so for planning purposes, the good co-chair here needs to move out of committee of about 5 minutes early. And so we'll maybe wrap it up in about 4 minutes. If there's a good break point as you go through,
sure.
Look for it.
We're going to quit early, 5 minutes.
Under there, I just talked about the programs for youth, but there are some other programs for adults, which include assertive community treatment, which is known as the ACT program, supported employment, tribal investment, crisis services, jail diversion, housing development, peer delivered services, sobering centers, and substance use disorder rates. Under the other programs, on the slide you can see is the Medicare Part A and Part B premium payments for qualifying individuals, also known as QMB, which is qualified Medicare beneficiary. These are not fully dual covered individuals. They are Medicare beneficiaries for whom we use Medicaid funds to pay their out-of-pocket co-insurance, co-pays, deductibles, but they are not enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. The Medicare Part D prescription drug coverage for Medicare beneficiaries is covered by Medicaid because Medicare Part D is optional, and persons on straight Medicare must obtain Part D from their health plans as an option if they desire. So Medicaid covers their prescription needs. The last one is COWM non-pregnancy benefit package. It covers emergency medical services only, and these services are matched with federal Medicaid funds. Few things that I want to share here is clients eligible for COWM or COWM Plus are not enrolled in managed care or coordinated care organizations. The non-Medicaid safety net services that are provided through SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and State General Fund serve two important needs, even after the ACA expansion of Medicaid. The first one is they provide mental health, substance use disorder, problem gambling services to those who, for whatever reason, are not eligible for Medicaid or have fallen off the Medicaid temporarily. These individuals can be in a psychiatric crisis if there are even short lapses in their medication or other treatment. The other thing the non-Medicaid safety net service really provides is services that are not allowed or covered under Medicaid, but they generate Medicaid savings through improved outcomes and lower incidence of acute episodes, including housing support like rental assistance and recovery housing, other supports like jail diversion. So with that, that was information for this slide. And it's not yet 4 minutes, but if you have any questions.
Yeah, looking at the slides, I think it's probably a good breaking point before we get into the one system. So are there any other questions before we move on? All right, with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn for today, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Thank you.